Good evening. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, members and guests of the Vancouver Institute. I'm very pleased to welcome you again to the opening lecture of our fall series for the 61st annual meeting of the Vancouver Institute. To those of you who are not members, I think you've already been exposed to a commercial, which is turned off now, how you can join. We don't insist that you do join. We welcome you if you do. The lectures, which are held here every Saturday night at 8:15, are free, of course. If you wish to join, we would be glad to welcome you. Now it's my honor and my pleasure to introduce our guest speaker, who this evening is the Honorable Thomas O. Enders, U.S. Ambassador to Canada, who was just appointed in the end of 1975 to his post, and who has kindly accepted this forum for his first major address in Western Canada. When I first read the curriculum vitae on Mr. Enders, his background and career in government and departmental service, I readily imagined a very distinguished but somewhat elderly gentleman. After all, he'd attended three universities.
That ages you.
He secured a BA degree from Yale, where he led his class. And then he proceeded to take an MA in the University of Paris, and followed that with another MA at Harvard. He entered government service as a research specialist in the Division of Research and Analysis for the Far East, and then went on foreign service as an economic officer in Stockholm from 1960 to 1963. From then until 1966, he was a supervisory international economist in the Bureau of European Affairs. And from 1966 to 1968, he was a special assistant to the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. I should have known when I saw the story about him that he wasn't very old, because in 1970, he received the Arthur S. Fleming Award as an outstanding young man in government. Since 1974, Mr. Enders has been Assistant Secretary of State for Economic and Business Affairs in the U.S. government. Before that, he was Deputy Chief of Mission in Belgrade, and he served also as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for International Monetary Affairs. So you can see he's not only an economist and a career diplomat, but despite what I thought, that he might have accepted this appointment as a sort of a gracious retirement from active service in his old age, you see how wrong I was. He's just started. He's just beginning. Among other matters, Mr. Enders is deeply interested in energy and the environment, and has chosen to speak to us tonight on an environment shared, Canada and the United States.
Enders.
Thank you, Mr. Justice, for that very gracious introduction, and thank you all for coming out on what must be the loveliest evening of the season, when everybody should be out enjoying the environment rather than talking about it. And I think I particularly appreciate the opportunity to meet with you tonight and to talk about it, given the kinds of competition that represents. And let me say, Mr. Justice, also that not only is this the first speech that I've given in Western Canada, or at least in British Columbia, Alberta excepted, from Western Canada, but it's the first time ever that I've found a lectern that I can actually read from. Generally speaking, there I find that my remarks are so far away from me that I often wonder if there isn't a message in that. But the throughout much of our history, Canada and the United States, the environment was the enemy. In Canada and in the United States, we are both challenged, sometimes even threatened by the immensity and the hostility of the lands we were given to settle. And up until this century, your history is the struggle to pierce the shield, overarch the plains, master the Rockies, and join all of Canada together. In your life, again and again, the central theme was the struggle to overcome cold, snow, distance, and loneliness. It was like that in the United States, too. A frontier was a basic experience for Americans. Fencing the land, taming the rivers, exploiting natural resources, peopling the country, overcoming the solitude and the danger of wilderness, and all of those verbs suggest conquest. I think that Americans briefly marveled at the beauty of their land, mainly in the 18th century, and then they moved to conquer it. But now our concerns are quite opposite. We have both so well mastered nature, grown so numerous, so used up our resources that we must urgently preserve and in many cases recreate the environment we combated before. Our concern is partly self-preservation. We're afraid to poison ourselves. Once the dead lake, the acid rain, the lung damage that car exhausts cause were things that you read about. Now everybody has direct experience of them. But I think that the apprehension really goes deeper. Canadians and Americans who are nurtured in the richness of life of this continent don't want to be left alone here in a world in which they're only men and men's works, and in which other forms of life have been so devastated as to be insignificant. We need the solitude we used to fear. We need to relate to something larger than ourselves. We cannot be ourselves without beauty. So protection of the environment fulfills a spiritual need too. Now, coming in a few years' time, this change in our view of the environment has had a revolutionary impact. It's changing the economics of production in a remarkable way. Already, U.S. enterprises devote 6% of new investment to pollution abatement, 6%. That's up from 1 or 2, perhaps, 10 years ago. And many think that that figure will rise to 10 or even 15 as environment costs become fully internalized. It's also changing the balance of politics, redistributing power away from entrepreneurs and companies, giving consumers, citizens, neighbors, groups a strong new voice in affairs. It's changing our governance in important ways, giving vast new powers to regulatory bodies and processes outside traditional parliamentary and executive machinery. And it's bringing to the service some difficult problems in democracy. In many cases, environmental protection and economic activity are mutually supporting. But where there is a trade-off, how do you balance off the claims of those that need jobs with the claims of preserving the environment? Or I think even more searching and subtle, how do you assure that environmental controls will benefit everybody, including low-income and disadvantaged guys, and not just those that have made it and already have access to the countryside, to lakes and forests? As befits countries that stand not just for interests but for values, Canada and the United States led the movement to protect the environment. We both established national park systems at the end of the 19th century, when after more than a century of mutual distrust, we moved decisively towards cooperation. Where did we move? We moved in the environment. We acted first, signing the Boundary Waters Treaty of 1909, which is still one of the century's most fruitful innovations in international relations. And in the last generation, it was clearly the United States and Canada that pioneered in setting environmental standards, developing budgets, devising processes for environmental controls. And an enormous amount has been achieved. Throughout the United States, there is a trend towards an across-the-board improvement in air quality. Most major lake and river systems have shown vital signs of improvement, and the same is true of Canada. But in my country, and in yours, the huge task of restoring all our damaged areas to minimum standards has only just begun, and new threats appear constantly. Now, Canada and the United States have also achieved a good deal along the border. Deterioration of the Great Lakes has been slowed and possibly stopped. We are extending and perfecting the practice of consulting in advance on actions that might cause pollution in the other country. Indeed, out of sensitivity and respect for each other, we've probably done better on border problems than most of those that are internal, purely affecting only Americans and Canadians. But much remains to be done along the border, too. We have yet to restore water quality in the Great Lakes. The effects of actions taken today may not be fully affected for 10 or 15 years, and we're just beginning to see the results of our investment. We have yet to nail down controls on offshore pollution. We have only begun to tackle airborne pollution, and a roster of individual problems requires constant attention. Yet our mutual concerns, as you talk about the environment, go beyond border problems as such, because the two countries relate to each other in their whole environments. If, for example, Ontario or the Midwest fails to improve air quality, the long-term impact on the other country will be massive, however manageable the short-term problem. And if, as many now fear, one of the serious problems in the Great Lakes is airborne phosphorus pollution, the solution will require action in both countries in areas far from the border. If, as scientists are now concluding in both of our countries, aerosols are degrading the Earth's ozone layer and exposing us to increased incidence of skin cancer, it doesn't do any good to move on them only in the States or only in Canada. We must move on them in both countries and indeed elsewhere as well. So what I'd like to address tonight is the full range of our environmental concerns. Let me first talk about the three major pollution problems that we have, which is water, seaborne, and air, and what we are doing about them. Then I'd like to turn to how we do our environmental business together, institutions, processes that permit us to assure mutual protection while respecting each other's sovereignty. Finally, I'd like to consider with you what more we should be doing. Water pollution is the most familiar to all of us. Sewage, industrial waste, seepage from mine tailings, the dying lake, the barren river, the leached field, each of us has direct experience with it. And it's a problem all up and down the border. British Columbia, there are plans to develop coal mines near the border. And those risk contaminating a wilderness river, the Flathead, which is part of the Glacier National Park in Montana. Saskatchewan has plans for a power generating plant on the Poplar River. And that risk decreased water quality and quantity in northeastern Montana. In North Dakota, the Canadian government feels that the Garrison Diversion irrigation project, if carried to completion as originally conceived, would pollute water flowing into Manitoba. In Quebec, water level control projects on the Richelieu River could adversely alter the Lake Champlain ecosystem in the United States. Now, some of these projects have already been, others soon will be, referred to the IJC for an impartial determination of the environmental impact. Without question, the big problem that we have in water pollution is the Great Lakes. Both the United States and Canada have for many years misused the lakes, until finally in 1972, the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement established a schedule of action and a timetable for restoring them. Since that time, both countries have made a lot of progress. In both, programs to achieve prescribed water quality objectives either were completed or in process of implementation by the end of 1975. In fact, 98%, that's an impressive figure, 98% of the population served by sewers in Canada now have adequate treatment in the Great Lakes area, although there are still some projects to be completed, particularly in the Thunder Bay area. Now, in the United States, approximately 60% of the lakeside population is now serviced by treatment facilities. You'll ask, why has the United States lagged so much? Well, this is the answer. When we signed the agreement in 1972, Canada was already treating municipal waste of 80% of its lakeside population. We were much lower, treating the waste of only 10%. Since signature, you have largely completed the job on your side. But we have also made enormous progress. We've mounted the largest public works program ever carried out by any government, any time, any place in the world. We've already invested $5 billion. In 4 years, we have brought on stream municipal waste facilities for 9 million people. When facilities in Detroit and Cleveland start up in 2 years' time, that figure will go to 12 million. We expect to complete the job by 1981. I think that Canada is to be congratulated on its head start in cleaning up municipal waste before the agreement was signed, but you should not be disappointed in our progress in the States also. Realistically, it is hard to imagine how more could have been achieved in 4 years. I should add that compliance with the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement has also brought wider benefits, helping to develop protection against degradation of water resources in the future anywhere in the United States. Under amendments to the Water Pollution Control Act of 1972, industry and municipalities have to meet prescribed standards covering discharge waste anywhere in the states. A permit system ensures enforcement. Now we can already see the results of this enormous effort in the lakes. In 1975, water quality, as best we can index it, and it's a very tricky matter because there are lots of things that have to be taken into account, showed no significant deterioration. But it's still much too early to predict a significant improvement. Even when all the treatment facilities are in place on our side, as they now largely are on yours. Phosphorus, one of the principal contaminants in the lakes, continues to be a major problem. On our side of the border, we are having less success than we hoped in removing phosphates through municipal waste treatment. Canada's limitations on phosphates in detergents do not appear to have been entirely successful either. And Americans continue to worry about whether the cure, the substitutes that you put in the detergents for phosphates, aren't as bad as the disease. But because the problem is so severe, both Canada and the United States are again reviewing the evidence on the health effects of phosphate substitutes to see whether we both shouldn't impose a phosphate ban. Equally worrisome, and this could be really serious, it now appears that a significant part of the Great Lakes phosphorus problems may be airborne fertilizers carried up from fields all over central United States and Canada. It is symptomatic of the fast pace of technological change that we didn't even know about this a few years ago. A major new source of pollution reaching crisis proportion in the lakes is electric circuitry, PCBs, if that's a familiar word for you, polychlorinated biphenyls, Anybody who's familiar with that really ought to stand up, I think, this one. Are used in the manufacture of electrical capacitors, transistors, and plastics. We didn't know about PCBs a few years ago either, but we're now finding that they could be a cancer-causing agent. Canada already has its Environmental Contaminants Act to regulate PCBs, and our Toxic Substances Act will shortly clear Congress. However, we will need parallel strategies in proceeding to remove PCBs from manufacturing and ultimately from our water. Thus, even with the early completion of all the municipal waste facilities, and we know now that that will happen in the next few years, and it's required by the Water Quality Agreement, the struggle to clear up the Great Lakes is only just beginning and must go on for a very long time. Now, the second area of concern, and one that is particularly important in your part of the country, is coastal and offshore pollution. After the experience of the last years, there really is no coastal community that does not fear an oil spill, and few that have not suffered from other contamination from the seas, from onshore, or from ships. Now, both our countries are beginning to arm against this threat. There's a widening international consensus that it's up to the coastal states to exercise responsibility for controlling pollution for up to 200 miles off their shores. Your new Ocean Dumping Act and our Coastal Zone Management Act give us both authority to take action in this field. And some minimal standards have been set in the International Ocean Dumping Convention, but we think and you think they're not high enough and should be raised. As for vessel source pollution, the right way to control it is through universally accepted standards established in the 1975 Convention on the Prevention of Pollution by Ships. Both the United States and Canada have moved vigorously to minimize potential damage from the growing tanker traffic on the Pacific coast. Tanker routes to and from Alaska have been moved out from the coast to lessen the risk. Canadian citizens, in an unprecedented move, I think it really is without precedent, were granted access to the $100 million U.S. contingency fund should an accident occur during the transportation of oil from Alaska to the United States. A voluntary vessel traffic separation scheme has been established in the Juan de Fuca Strait to prevent collisions. Vessel control management systems are in place in Puget Sound. And we're expecting down in Washington on October 13 a Canadian delegation to set up a joint traffic management system for the Puget Sound, which will keep vessels under positive radar control throughout their passage in the strait, very much as planes are kept under positive radar control by air controller systems, so that we can be sure that we have the risks of increased traffic, particularly petroleum-bearing traffic on the straits, under control. But I should say that Juan de Fuca, as we see it, is not a one-way street. Petroleum pollution problems in the Pacific Northwest are, in our view, inevitably a shared responsibility. Increased oil shipments are coming into Puget Sound to replace oil exports that used to come by pipeline from Canada. Larger quantities may or may not come in the future for northern tier refineries in the states, depending on decisions on oil pipeline routes for moving Alaskan crude. And during the energy crisis, large amounts of Western Canadian oil were shipped from Western Canada through the strait, bound via the Panama Canal for Portland, Maine, for that pipeline to meet the needs of Montreal and Eastern Canada. This posed an increased threat to our coasts and waters as to yours, but one that we thought acceptable as good neighbors in a time of crisis. The third area of concern is air pollution. Each of our great cities is threatened by car exhaust. Most of the sulfur-bearing smoke comes from power generation, I think in both our countries, and in both our countries also. There are a fair number of communities that have to worry about acid rain, which is caused by sulfur emissions from smelting coal-burning power plants. Increasingly, there is concern about fertilizers. Now, we expect to make major progress in air pollution abatement in the United States over the next 5 years. All emissions must now, by law, be reduced. Further legislation on exhaust is expected shortly. New coal and oil-fired power plants must meet national ambient air quality standards. And our current forecast, and I think this is of importance to Canada, our current forecast is that all of the major cities within 200 miles of the border will reach the new standards of air quality set by law by 1980. A major cleanup is in progress, and you will be among the beneficiaries of it. Canada, too, has been making progress in controlling air pollution. But Canada's Clean Air Act is not as far-reaching as ours in dealing with polluters. Your federal government may take out after industrial polluters only when there is a serious problem to health, such as in the case of trace metals. One of the biggest pollutants is sulfur, of course. The Canadian government has just amended new federal air quality standards setting maximum tolerance levels for sulfur dioxide. And this should help a lot. In the air, our greatest common problem for the moment is in the Detroit-Windsor industrial area. The state of Michigan and the province of Ontario are working on this quite closely together. And they have a memorandum of understanding which they signed in 1974, which commits them to cooperation in implementing their respective air pollution control programs with a completion date by 1978. But while it could be argued that the United States has caused the bulk of Windsor's air pollution problems, I think that's true. Air pollution is not a one-way problem. Mostly prevailing winds blow from Canada to the United States, and so we're concerned about what you do. In fact, it was the landmark Trail Smelter case, which was here in BC in 1928, where Canadian smokestack emissions were polluting the American environment, which helped establish, really broke the ground for the international principle that it is up to the polluter, he must have liability for paying for pollution damage. Now, these are the main problems that we have. And what I'd like to ask now is how we handle them, what kinds of mechanisms we use. Now, in the U.S., the environmental impact assessment system is key. It requires a full examination in advance of all federal government actions, any type at all, regulatory, a permit, any authorization, as well as any expenditure of funds, which can have a significant impact on the environment. But moreover, private developments, which are in some way subject to federal jurisdiction, however tenuous and however marginal, have also to be subject to the environmental impact statement system. The process is open, it's public, and it has ample safeguards for the interests of all those concerned. And this system gives Canada an excellent opportunity to identify, comment upon, negotiate about potential trans-border impacts of U.S. development activities at an early stage. Now, Canada has a similar assessment procedure for federal projects having environmental impact, but the coverage is much less than in the States. I understand that there are efforts to strengthen the procedure. I'd like to say that we'd welcome the improved forewarning a strengthened Canadian assessment procedure would offer. Now, the United States has proposed, and Canada has agreed to build on this separate two assessment systems, a reciprocal notification arrangement, at least on a quarterly basis, on projects with potential cross-border impact, so that each country would know in early and in advance what it will have to contend with. Now, another practice that can help us is consultation. To some extent, we've been doing this ever since we had the Boundary Waters Treaty signed in 1909, and in recent cases, and this is, I think, important, the idea has emerged pretty firmly that we should consult in advance of actions that might cause pollution in the other country, not just consult while we were building or after we had built, but in advance. And we hope very much on our side, and I think many in Canada share this hope, that this will now be the norm. Thirdly, negotiation of joint agreements handled specific problems can be very helpful. A classic example of this is the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement, of course. The advantage of this approach is that the two governments can work out accepted, verifiable goals and firm resource commitment. It can also make easier for each government to obtain the required appropriation. And I think that's really quite important in a way. It's a process by which, by defining by negotiation what the goal should be, that then has the status of an international agreement which both countries will feel a particular compulsion to honor, and they may be able to do more together than they might be able to do separately. The umbrella, of course, for all these agreements is the 1909 Boundary Waters Treaty, which committed both of us not to pollute the other to the injury of health and property. Another strategy, which we've often used and is particularly important now, is multilateral agreement on pollution problems, notably in the current Law of the Sea negotiations. Some problems, like vessel source pollution, can probably only be solved by a multilateral agreement. Some minimum international standards should also exist for exploration and exploitation of the continental shelf. And the proposed International Seabed Authority should have the responsibility for prescribing and enforcing anti-pollution efforts in its area of operation. The United States also believes that the solution to the special problems of Arctic pollution can perhaps best be found in the Law of the Sea negotiations, and we should try to exploit that opportunity quite vigorously. For all these reasons, it's vital, and for many others, to break the deadlock in the Law of the Sea negotiations at the next session in May 1977. Now, all these are important ways of dealing with our environmental business, but often the most effective means of dealing with it is our shared institutions. The International Joint Commission, created with foresight by the drafters of the Boundary Waters Treaty of 1909, offers an excellent mechanism to handle transborder pollution problems. Its strength is in its equality of representation, same number on both sides, its impartiality, its technical expertise, and its experience. It's been charged with monitoring the performance of governments under the terms of the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement, and it was really the IJC that brought that problem forcefully to public attention. It regulates uses of boundary and transboundary waters, and it advises the governments on matters relating to air quality. It's a unique example of how two countries have worked together to handle a joint problem. Now, as you can see, there's already a lot that we're doing together to protect our environment. But we can and should do more. But first, we can do more to ensure that our future environmental standards are coordinated by consulting in advance of requesting legislation, whether it's aerosols, PCBs, fertilizers, detergents, auto emissions. You get a lot less protection when one country imposes standards and the other doesn't. Where pollution controls may affect a country's ability to compete internationally, as in the case of PCBs or aerosols, you've got some industrial interests that are at stake. Agreement on parallel standards can help each of us get the needed action. Our experience with the Great Lakes and with coastal pollution shows how uncoordinated approaches, when we just have slightly different standards and have a hard time policing quality standards and parameters that are not entirely compatible, how that can hamper progress on both sides. And it, of course, remains true that neither of us can accept an obligation always to implement similar standards, and where we think we must, each of us should act on his own, as you did in detergents and we did in using a permit system to enforce our laws. A practice has grown up of close coordination between our environment protection agencies with meetings at ministerial level at least once a year. We should use these procedures vigorously to coordinate standard. Secondly, we should develop our mutual coverage of liability for damages. The principle of the polluter pays is widely established, but requires long and costly negotiation to pursue. We're now considering legislation in the United States to provide a comprehensive oil spill contingency fund, which would assure prompt and adequate compensation for injured parties. And one of the questions we're asking ourselves is whether foreign claimants, including Canadians, should be given access to that fund if no reciprocal privileges are extended. What I'd like to suggest is that Canada and the United States ought to consider whether a joint or reciprocal approach should not be adopted to assure that nationality doesn't interfere with prompt and adequate compensation of people who are injured by a spill. But third, we can perfect our bilateral institutions, particularly the International Joint Commission. A number of suggestions have been made for rationalizing and enhancing its role. We'd be interested in exploring these suggestions with the Canadian government. Now, in the end, the validity of any general approach lies in the results that you get in specific cases. And I should mention four here. And the first one is Ross Dam. Well, Ross Dam, we're on the American side. We're well aware of the concern in British Columbia about changes in the Skagit Valley that will result from a decision to raise the dam. I think you're probably aware of what bothers Seattle. Some time ago, the International Joint Commission approved Seattle's application to raise the dam, and that city has had a valid agreement with British Columbia for compensation as required by the Commission's order of approval. Seattle is concerned about its future power supply, a situation which has been made more difficult by reduced energy shipments from Canada. I understand that there have been discussions by the authorities directly concerned, the BC government and the Washington State authorities, and I think that's probably where the negotiations on this should lie. I'm hopeful that through that channel a balanced solution can be reached. Second issue, transmission of Alaskan oil. I think you're probably familiar with three projects which would introduce North Slope oil into the West Coast, Canadian and U.S., through Southern California, which would use an unused gas pipeline to the south center of the states, into Puget Sound by tanker, and then to the Midwest by a pipeline, and into Kitimat and by pipeline to the Pacific Northwest and Midwest. The important thing to recognize, I think, is that these projects are not necessarily alternatives several of them may be done in combination. And each has its environmental dangers. Kitimat would clearly risk pollution of an area that does now have petroleum traffic. But at the same time, it would diminish the amount of petroleum traffic on the Puget Sound and lessen the risk of pollution there. There are also the problems of pipeline construction for each of these alternatives. Now, Washington, D.C. is giving close study to these alternatives, and we understand that the Ottawa authorities, as well as the British Columbia authorities, are too. And this is the kind of issue that we'll want to keep in very close touch with your authorities as we go down to a decision, both of us. A third issue is the Beaufort Sea. Canadian companies are drilling there. They just stopped today. And we'll probably want to drill on the American side someday too. We clearly want to be sure that the best technology is used, that the technology works, that full protection is provided for native peoples, for the environment, and for wildlife. Americans can learn a lot from the Canadian experience. But there isn't any doubt that this season drilling program poses a potential threat to the environment of the North Slope of Alaska, as well as to Canadian waters and shores. Both governments have attempted to assure that this potential threat is minimal, developing contingency spill planning and compensation agreements. But frankly, when we view the great lead time which we gave you to comment and study on the entire Alyeska project, and when we note the large size, the openness, and the availability of the U.S. Liability Fund to Canadian claimants, we've been disappointed by the short advance notice, about 30 days, with which the entire Beaufort Sea question emerged, and with the proposed relatively modest way U.S. claimants would be handled should they have cause for suit for damages in Alaska. We hope this also can be worked out. Now, the fourth issue is gas pipelines. Three routes are under consideration, and certainly one of the prime concerns is that whichever route is selected, it should be the safest. And they have different environmental effects. The Alaska LNG route would increase hydrocarbon traffic off British Columbia. The Mackenzie Valley route would cross the Alaska Wildlife Range and stimulate development in the Northern Territories. If combined with a spur to the Mackenzie Delta coming down across the Northern Territories to the Alcan route, the Alcan route following the highway down through Alaska and across northern British Columbia could result in more construction in the far north than the other two. In the United States, legislation governing the decision and the selection and approval of a gas pipeline is now before the Congress. Senate and House versions of this legislation provide slightly different timetables. But when finally passed, the legislation will probably require that the Federal Power Commission, which is our equivalent of your National Energy Board, complete its hearings, including its assessment of environmental impact, and make a recommendation to the President by May 1 of next year. The President would then have to make a decision by September 1, after he had had a chance to discuss with Canada their interest. And the President's decision would be submitted to Congress for review and final approval. Now, for those routes which traverse Canada, there's been extensive study through the Berger hearings of the impact such construction activity would have upon native peoples and the environment. In fact, the last of the routes to be proposed, the so-called Alcan route that I just discussed, was in part a response to suggestions by Justice Berger that it warranted further study. Additionally, the National Energy Board is holding hearings in the area, and on the U.S. side, hearings are being held as well. It's a kind of a proposition that we should be studying very closely together, consulting each other closely before we both move towards decisions. Now, no approach to the environment, I think, can work. This is a very special area of our concerns and activity, unless it is applied with sensitivity and understanding. We have to recognize that there are problems in the environment all up and down the border, some of them which are caused by the states, some of them caused by Canada, but all of them clearly of mutual concern. We can't make any progress if we try to trade them off, linking one problem to the other. No community along the border could accept that. Each problem obviously has to be considered on its merits and settled accordingly. But it's also true that only if all communities, not just those that happen to have a problem now, are engaged in action to improve the environment, will we be able to make headway. Secondly, we have to respect your wish and ours to be masters in our own house, formulate, execute our own policies, protect our own environments, not have it protected by another country. Yet we have to recognize also that often interests and coalitions will cut across national lines, and that we both have a major interest in parallel implementation of standards. That doesn't mean that we should accept a continental environment policy, which would distribute benefits and costs according to some abstract formula, as if the border were not there, because I think you'll agree that would violate everything that relations between Canada and the United States are all about. But it does mean that we should make every effort to coordinate our separate policies. Now, to some people, you can't have any compromise at all of environmental standards. But probably most people in both countries want to consider how those standards relate to jobs and development before they make their decisions. I think it's pretty clear, though, that the scope for trade-offs is less across the border, where the sensitivities of neighbors is at risk, than it may be in our purely domestic affairs. That doesn't mean that we have to cancel any development that might, under some conceivable circumstances, harm the environment of the other country. That would condemn some sections of both countries to a no-growth situation. What it does mean is that we must take special precautions in border situations. Consult fully in advance all the potentially affected. Build in available protective devices, sometimes beyond those that are normally required. Provide, where appropriate, effective contingency planning and generous liability arrangements. We have to do more where the border is involved. Now, I think that environmental affairs is one of the sectors where the new symmetry in Canadian-American relations shows clearly. We both want to have our own environmental policy, separate from the other, with separate administrations and institutions. Yet clearly there's a big penalty, equal, I think, on both sides, if we develop in ways incompatible with the other country. In the past, we've have both fought with nature, been prodigal with it, wasted it. Now we have to protect it, re-nurture it. Some places recreate it from nothing. And I think we can only succeed fully if we do this together. Now our goal should be, I think, as far as the environment is concerned, to make ours the longest effectively defended border in the world. And it seems to me that there's really a lot to defend. One of the first glimpses that I, as a student of literature 20 years ago, had of Vancouver, and I didn't get here in person until March, was through Malcolm Lowry, who was a Vancouver writer who died in the 50s. And you remember how he described the outlook from the city? He said, beginning of one of his stories, he said, I haven't been here on a day like this, but it made a big impression on me. He said, it was a day of spindrift, blowing sea foam, black clouds presaging rain over the mountains from the sea by a wild March wind. And he went on, but a clear silver light came from along the horizon where the sky itself was like glowing silver. And far away over in America, the snowy volcanic peak of Mount Hood stood on high, disembodied, cut off from the earth. The angelic wings, he said, of the seagulls circling over the treetops shone very white against the black sky. Fresh snow from the night before lay far down the slopes of the Canadian mountains, whose freezing summits mass peak behind spire, jaggedly traversed the country northward as far as the eye could reach. And highest of all, an eagle with the poise of a skier shot endlessly down the world. Well, you can imagine the effect that that made on somebody who had not been here and who now comes. I think that Malcolm Lowry's eloquence captured the grandeur of our environment, so deserving of our best efforts at preservation. And my purpose here tonight is to say that we Americans will join you with energy and with determination in that noble task. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've just heard an eulogy to Vancouver. I should say that we had some doubt earlier this evening that our speaker would arrive here at all. He was on the West Coast at near Ucluelet, and some of you know Long Beach and Wickenagin. And not only was afraid he wouldn't turn up here, but he was afraid he might defect from the United States. However, he has turned up. I've explained to our guest tonight that we have a custom here of inviting questions. And I ask only, and I think you'll appreciate this, that the questions you ask are really questions and not sub-speeches. We've had one speech tonight. We just like to have questions now. And don't even make them what we lawyers call leading questions. Yes, sir.
Nuclear fission wastes, a matter of grave mutual concern.
Yes, sir.
Would you rephrase the question?
Yes, perhaps I could say, isn't the matter of the disposal of nuclear waste of grave mutual concern? The answer is clearly yes. The development of nuclear energy and through particularly the light water reactors, which have been used in Europe, Japan, and the United States, presents a poisonous end product, which is extraordinarily difficult to store. It also presents the international community with end products that can be processed, as you know, into plutonium with the right, a very expensive, technologically sophisticated, but quite possible process. One of the biggest tasks that the international community now has is to find circumstances in which it can recapture through such devices as multilateral reprocessing facilities, physical control over fissible materials, the control that we thought we had through safeguards over fissible materials, but which we've seen both Canada and the United States in the case of India could escape us at a critical point and enable the country to produce an explosive device. I agree with you, sir. This is one of the biggest international problems, and
we're a long ways yet from a solution to it.
Sir,
are you going to call the
to vote?
Are you going to recognize him? Is what I'm.
I'd like to ask if one has been involved in some of the problems on the Canadian side. This question. You seem in the States to have managed the problem of the jurisdiction of the federal power and the state power in a way which so far in Canada we have not yet achieved. And your comment on the poverty of the Canadian Clean Air Act really reflects the problem the Canadian federal government has had in terms of its jurisdiction vis-a-vis the provinces. In the States, you seem to have got over that problem, and I would like you to tell me how you did it.
Well, I hope I can comment on this without getting into constitutional affairs in Canada, which perhaps you will comment on, sir. The strategy employed in the United States was the classical one by which we have attempted to convert a constitution which relegates all powers not explicitly given to the federal government to state and local governments, the contrary of your constitution, I should say. The way we have done it is simply this, is that a federal law was passed which said that in addition to any federal regulation which may be required on constitutional grounds, that is to say, the central government has the authority to regulate any commodity which passes from one state to another, or any service which passes from one state to another. So in addition to that, any action such as the opening of a new port, construction of a mine which may be partly on federal lands, or anything which involves the federal government in any way will be subject to a new requirement, the environmental impact statement. Now, this is a time-honored strategy for developing new powers in the federal government. On the whole, in this instance, it's been little contested. In many others, it's been very much contested. I have no way of knowing whether a similar strategy is open to Canada, but so far it has gone quite far in the States, and it is classical, as I say. It's been used in many cases.
Sir, I have a question about the scale of the pollution problems. We live in countries of almost exactly the same size, but we have a tenth of the population, and I wonder whether your impressions are that our pollution problems are comparable to yours in the United States. That is, are you being generous in sharing the problem with us?
I think the answer to that is that in places where few Canadians live, there seems to be little pollution, and that also, although there are fewer such places in the States, they seem to be about the same effect. But if I'm not mistaken, that in places where there are cities, the problem is almost exactly the same. And as you know, 18 out of the 22 million Canadians live within 200 miles of the American border. 50-odd of the 215 million Americans live within 200 miles of the border, and so that we have plenty to work on. I think if you set up a standard by which we shall all try to meet whichever the highest standard is in each sector, maybe we'll make some progress on this kind of an issue.
Mr. McAllister?
Mr. Ambassador, we appreciate your chief of the environment. I'd like to extend the environmental question to where not only the environment but people are really and actually in danger from the nuclear weaponry that both our countries and other countries have amassed. The present information from your scientists and from your strategic experts is that you're now in the process of unbalancing the balance of terror with certain weapons systems. This indicates to a motivation which is more interested in destruction than in keeping life and the environment. Would you comment on the possibility that NATO, Canada, and the United States would spend as much on making friendships around the world, good lasting friendships based on economics, as you are spending on nuclear weaponry?
Well, I think this is an objective which not only the Canadian government and people, but the American government and people and that of other NATO countries share. We have found no way so far, I think you know, to deal with the extraordinary development of military power other than by attempts to balance it and gradually to reduce it. In the course of the last few years, through the first SALT agreement and through efforts now at a second SALT agreement dealing with offensive weapons, we've been able to achieve for the first time ever a lid on military power of a strategic character. The objective of the current negotiations on offensive weapons is to produce an actual rollback in the number of weapons available principally to the United States and to the Soviet Union. I think that those negotiations may well succeed. It's too early to say that they will succeed this year, but I'm confident that they will succeed within the next year or two, if not this year. And then for the first time, some of the monies that my country and the Soviet Union principally are spending on nuclear deterrence can be put to more productive use. I don't think that there's any question that we share the goal that you state, sir, but I think that no country would urge us, or indeed none of the friends of the Soviet Union would urge it, in the current state of international tension, which still remains, to unilaterally disarm. And that is not going to happen. Mutual disarmament will happen, I think. And we've made the first faltering steps towards it, and I expect that more serious, more purposeful steps will be made in the future. Let me say in passing that we are not in the United States developing weapons that would upset the arms balance. We are developing a follow-on system to the Polaris submarine, which is becoming obsolete. And you are telling us, if you say that we are developing weapons that upset the nuclear balance, you are telling us something that the Soviets, the principal concerned, are not telling us, because they have developed weapons which have submarines, which are now in service, which have a range of 4,000 miles, weapons that we do not now have, and which we do not expect to have until 1979. The United States is not taking the first action and has not been so told by the Soviet Union.
He may wish to comment more on this.
I beg your pardon. This is a discussion on the environment, not on nuclear energy.
Yes.
Thank you.
I'm very glad to hear that you're going to allow us to continue to, in our own particular way, achieve 200 years, we hope. My question really on the environment is...
Is there any way to stop you? I can't... I wish you well, too, but...
My question then is on NAWAPA, the North American Water Scheme, which seems to be an aggressive force within the United States to develop water systems from Canada down through your southern United States. I'm particularly thinking of the Rocky Mountain Trench, the diversion of the Hudson Bay down through the Red River and Garrison into the southern central United States, and the James Bay diversion. I think we have read comments from all over the United States, some of which have indicated that you're even going to go to war to take the water out of Canada.
Yes, I will comment on that. Those
those proposals are nonsense. They bear no resemblance to any proposals that are being considered by any authorities in the United States, and they are completely inconsistent with the 1909 treaty, which in fact specifies reciprocity between the two countries. They, in short, are poppycock.
Could you speak up a little louder, please?
Do we need to worry about biological warfare research?
Do we need to worry about biological warfare research?
Well, I don't know what your threshold for worries is, and there are always additional things to worry about. I think that, though, you should be comforted by the fact that the principal countries concerned, countries that have the capability for biological warfare, have been concerned, that is to say, the Soviet Union, Britain, France, United States in particular, have been concerned by the threat that a competition might develop in this area also, and have been undertaking for the past 5 years a negotiation in Geneva, which has already produced substantial international safeguards against the abuse of these technical possibilities. I think that we are all afraid that we might be pushed into the kind of scenario that obviously concerns you, and I think there's been a lot of international action to prevent that.
May I ask a question, if I'm permitted to do so? I'm asking a question about the recent report in the paper dealing with tanker routes, about the refusal by three federal judges in Seattle to allow a statute to exist in the Washington books, which forbade tankers of over 120,000 tons. I thought 120,000 is a pretty big tanker, but you can't have them over 120,000 tons, according to the statute, going down the Straits of Juan de Fuca. Is that purely a question of federal and state jurisdiction, or is there any policy matter there?
Well, I'm uninformed about the detail of that decision and can't answer it, but there is, in fact, no very clear delimitation of powers in this field between the states and the federal government, and I think you could quite well see competitive attempts to regulate in this area. That is a matter, one of many, which our Constitution doesn't settle definitively, and so it could well be that a state could make a claim of this kind.
Yes, sir.
There appears to be a disparity between environmental control policies arrived at jointly by Canada and the states and the mechanism for implementing that policy. I'm thinking, for example, in the case of the Garrison Diversion Project, the both Manitoba and the Canadian governments have asked that this be stopped pending further investigation. Yet, it is my understanding that the American Army engineers are pursuing it.
Yes, sir. We have been requested by the Canadian government, acting for itself and for Manitoba, to stop the project pending further consultation and decision. Those parts of the project which could have an impact on the quality of water in Manitoba have, in fact, been stopped. And the matter, as you know probably, has been referred to the International Joint Commission. And they are working on a report. I believe their report, which was expected to be published in October, will now be published or now made available next summer, I think July, which is unfortunate. But pending that report and their recommendations, actions which might have the effect of polluting water in Canada have been suspended.
Mr. Justice Rattan, since you have ruled that we can discuss only nuclear energy tonight, I would like to ask Ambassador Anderson whether, in his opinion,
Mr. Ford or Mr. Carter generated the most nuclear energy in their face.
Well, they both addressed this, as a matter of fact, and one was for it and one was against it, and I think they pretty well canceled each other out on that issue.
I thought I was ruling against nuclear energy, not in favor of it.
Yes?
Mr. Ambassador, you have avoided the, you're summing up the possibilities of transportation of oil. Seem to have avoided the question of the Mackenzie Valley pipeline. I wonder if we can take that as an indication that the U.S. government does not consider that as a possibility.
Well, I think that everybody hear the question. I thought I heard it right, in which you said that in my discussion I had avoided the issue of the Mackenzie Valley pipeline, and that also I had avoided.
No, I'm just wondering if that means the U.S. government does not consider that as a possibility for transport of the oil from Alaska.
The Mackenzie Valley pipeline for oil? For gas? The proposal has been for a Mackenzie Valley pipeline for gas, and that is competing with the Alcan route and with an all U.S. route through liquefied natural gas. No, I don't think any one of those possibilities is ruled out at this stage. I don't think either Canada or the United States knows what the right interest, its right interest is at this point. But I think both of us feel we're going to have to make up our mind and what we want to do sometime early next year. I mean, a little bit around Easter time. I'm not ruling that out at all. Didn't mean to suggest that. On the other hand, it's just impossible to say at this moment what the right solution to that problem is.
Your Excellency, it's always a pleasure for us to have an ambassador as a speaker. And it's a double pleasure when the ambassador is entertaining, and it's a triple pleasure when the ambassador is entertaining and informative on the subject of environment. I think we all agree with you that the developments in the last several years concerning the environment and the way in which we handle environmental problems have been very gratifying. Many of us here remember about 18 or 20 years ago in the negotiation between the United States and Canada that things got rather warm, and the Canadian negotiators said, well, if it's cold water you want, it's a nickel a glass. Things have moved on. We now have many machineries for cooperation. I think it's recognized that our ways of approaching environmental problems have now been developed at the point where perhaps we can not relax our vigil concerning the environment, but certainly be much less concerned about our abilities to cope. And now perhaps we'll be able to move on to things like each other's television programs, perhaps the various sufferings we have at the hands of each other's citizens as tourists. I might say that the showing tonight is really surprising, considering it's a Saturday night, and so many of our citizens like to shop for their groceries in Belgium. I think we're all reassured by your remarks. More than that, sir, we're obviously reassured by your competence, and I think I can speak for all of us here present that we're delighted that you will be the United States Ambassador to Canada. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was very nice. Thank you.
Dean Larkin is very modest, and I should have introduced him to you as the thanker for our distinguished speaker tonight. Dean Larkin is the senior environmentalist in the University of British Columbia, and is therefore very, despite what he has said, he is very well qualified to speak about in the environment. That concludes our business tonight, ladies and gentlemen. Just notice the advertisement for your next meeting. Same price, same place, same time. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. That was nice.